On this episode of Skeptico, Dr. Mark Beckoff explains the perils facing research students interested in exploring controversial science.
Here's the catch-22. They've got you coming and going. If you don't support it, then you've got negative data, and negative data don't make a thesis, and people will say, well, what do you expect? It's a ludicrous idea. If you support it, then it's not explainable within the paradigm of science, and so you don't have anything there. And I think it would be suicide for a graduate student to do in terms of their future.
Stay with us for Skeptico.
Welcome to Skeptico, where we explore controversial science with leading researchers, thinkers, and their critics. I'm your host, Alex Sakaris, and all I can think about is dogs. Dogs, dogs, dogs. You know, up until a few months ago, I never paid much attention to dogs. Now it seems like dog stuff is all that I do. Podcasts about dogs' intelligence and dog emotions, networking with dog owners and dog owner groups, trying to find these telepathic dogs. But in my transformation from money-centered entrepreneur to science enthusiast, I've noticed something. I guess I'd call them shared lessons. And as I was putting together this show on animal emotions with Dr. Mark Beckoff, I thought of a lesson that every entrepreneur learns in one way or another, and that's the lesson of the fox and the hedgehog. The ancient saying goes that the fox knows many things, but the hedgehog knows one big thing. And as any successful entrepreneur will tell you, success in business is all about being a hedgehog rather than a fox. And as I thought about this saying, I couldn't help but see some parallels in the sides on the debate between skeptics and researchers on the cutting edge of human consciousness. How do smart, well-educated people like Richard Wiseman, Stephen Novella, and even last episode's guest, Dr. Stanley Korn, how do they stumble into such obvious blunders as you've heard them make on this show? Well, certainly a big part of the reason is that they're blinded by an outdated scientific paradigm that they just can't seem to get away from. But another reason is that they're a little bit too much fox and not enough hedgehog. Let me give you a quick example. Do you remember many episodes back when I had Richard Wiseman on Skeptico? If you do, then you recall that for the first time in 10 years, he admitted the obvious fact that his failed debunking produced data that matches the scientists he was trying to debunk. But then he added this.
In this particular instance, I'm not that impressed with the data that Rupert's collected. I think it's really interesting. I think there's still some methodological problems with it. And part of that is because you're trying to do an experiment in the real world with an animal. And that's just inherently a rather sort of messy thing to do.
Now, I suggest to you that that was a very fox-like thing to say. I mean, it sounds intelligent, even scientific, and at the same time, there's not a lot of substance to it. And for me, it never rang true either. I mean, the experiments these guys did, where they were trying to find out whether dogs knew whether their owners were coming home, is about as simple as it gets. And since then, I've talked to a lot of animal behavior researchers and asked them about Wiseman's effort to find some wiggle room out of the results. And even the most diehard skeptics in the group had to admit that Wiseman was just plain wrong. There's no rat's nest of complicating factors between human and animal interaction. These kind of experiments go on all the time and a lot more complicated than this. And this kind of stuff happens a lot with skeptics. They're so confident in their fox-like reasoning powers and so certain that the conclusion they've come to is right that they never get in there with the hedgehogs, the researchers who are on the front lines of science, to really understand what's going on. So forgive me if I devote yet another episode to dogs. And forgive me if I spend so much time searching for research participants that I don't have time to do more podcasts. But, well, I'm just a hedgehog. And hedgehogs just dig. Stay with us. We have a very interesting interview with Dr. Mark Beckoff on the emotional lives of animals and a very honest dialogue about how controversial science is done in academia. More Skeptico in just a minute.
I live up here in this cabin in the woods, up where nobody visits and probably nobody should.
We're joined today by a very distinguished researcher, writer, teacher, and animal rights advocate, Dr. Mark Beckoff, who, along with being Professor Emeritus at the University of Colorado, is the author of many books, including The Emotional Lives of Animals and The Smile of a Dolphin, and along with Jane Goodall, is co-founder of Ethologist for the Ethical Treatment of Animals. I started the interview by asking Mark about his longtime interest in animals.
My parents always told me that I always minded animals, which was the title of a book I wrote a few years ago. They told me that ever since I was a young kid, I would always ask them what an animal was thinking, what an animal was feeling, was the animal happy or sad? And when I was about 3 or 4 years old, I yelled at a man who was hitting his dog, and the guy chased my father. I've always felt this natural and, connection to animals. It just seems, it's always seemed very normal to me to try to guess what they're thinking, what they're feeling. Are they happy? Are they sad? Do they miss their friends? It never dawned on me that those couldn't be scientific questions that we could study.
And that's a real interesting point, and one I really want to focus on, because in reading the book, I think that's what was so great about it to me, is someone who is intellectually curious, but also trying to connect with maybe more of an emotional part or my heart as well. The book does a great job of balancing that, because it's wonderful to hear these stories, and you have many great ones in the book. But I think a lot of folks like me immediately want to go, okay, but hold on, where is the science behind that? And I think you do a good job of making the case that the science is really, really quite overwhelmingly there in favor of animals having quite a rich emotional life.
It's funny, because a lot of what I felt and other people have felt and we've been writing about for a long time is constantly now being verified by science. Science is basically, in a sense, catching up to what we already knew. And I don't mean that as an anti-science move. It's just that, I've always thought that mice were empathic, and now we know, based on scientific studies, that they are. So, the neurobiology, the study of brain imaging, is showing, that certain parts of the brain are very active, say, when animals play, when people play, and when people are saying they enjoy themselves. And lots of animals have the same brain structures and the same chemicals in the brain, and there's no reason to think that they don't, have their own feeling of joy, for example, when they play. So science is catching up, basically.
That's interesting about science catching up. And one of the things I wanted to discuss with you is this whole idea of a paradigm shift, because as you point out so well in your writings, there has been this paradigm shift in science, and the work that you've done and folks like Jane Goodall have done over the last 30 or 40 years really are viewed quite differently than they were before. And I thought it'd be interesting to hear from you what that's been like going through the whole cycle, if you will.
Right. Well, it's been difficult at times. When Jane Goodall came out of the field, after pioneering studies of chimpanzees, where they thought that, maybe she'd last for 6 months, and, she's now going into her 49th year. She had named all the animals. She had not had a university degree. She just thought it was just absolutely normal to name the animals. So, there was Flint and Feigen and Flo and Goblin and David Greybeard. But when she got back to Cambridge University, where she was doing her PhD, people said, you can't name the animals. That's being too subjective. Science is objective. And Jane just basically said, no. I have to name these animals. I'm living with them. They're my friends. I'm studying them. They're not like animals in a cage. And, she basically, essentially she just refused to not name them. She refused to refer to them as numbers. And I think you're right. I think what's happening over time is, when I was in graduate school, and this was, I knew of Jane's work, but I really never, I hadn't paid much attention to the details. I named the cats with whom I was working, and You know, in my book, I mention a cat named Speedo, who was a really rapid learner, and we were doing some brain studies. And I never would do them again, but I named this great, brilliant cat Speedo. And it was Speedo who basically told me, don't do this work anymore. Don't cut animals anymore. He looked at me in the eyes and basically said to me, why are you doing this? And, you know, everyone else at the medical school I was at was numbering their animals. And when I would talk about Speedo and I talk about Darkie and I talk about Blondie and Harry, they would look at me like there was something profoundly wrong. But over time, things have changed. Professional journals now, a lot of them allow the writers to talk about named animals. You don't read sentences like, the researcher studied Wolf 38 or Wolf 38 greeted or something, you know, Wolf 42. A lot of first-person stuff. And Rupert Sheldrake and I used to have a lot of conversations about this because Rupert told me that, I think I have the story right, Alex, that Rupert told me that when his son took biology, he was writing papers in the first person, and that the teacher said, you know, you're not supposed to do that. I'm sure Rupert and I had that conversation once. You know, so things are changing. I mean, and they're changing slowly, but with that paradigm change, of course, we're also getting big changes in how animals are viewed.
And that's, I guess, what I was really referring to. For just anyone to say, my dog is happy when I get home, that's no longer such a controversial statement that has to be kind of parsed down to, well, you know, you're anthropomorphizing your animal's behavior. I mean, there's still some of that, but the tide has kind of shifted over the other way where we say, yeah, we can all kind of acknowledge the obvious. And, you know, I thought there was an interesting point in there as well in terms of it is obvious and it's always been obvious. And from a scientific standpoint, it's also kind of curious that even the idea, and you point this out in the book, and it really struck me that the notion that animals don't have an emotional life really contradicts another cherished paradigm, and that's one of evolution. I mean, if animals don't have, how did we get an emotional life if none of our predecessors had an emotional life? So I think there was never really a solid ground for believing that animals are completely without an emotional experience.
Right, and that's a great way to put it. You know, if you look at Darwin, Charles Darwin put forth, you know, what he calls this notion of evolutionary continuity. And, you know, essentially, you know, people just would say, well, if we have it, then animals have it. And so you're right. Where did our emotions come from if other animals don't have it? I suppose you could just appeal to a whole lot of different processes, but they're all almost supernatural. They're all not really science.
Right, yeah. In defense of science, sometimes skeptics ask us to believe even more radical ideas than just the obvious, in this case, that our animals are, for the most part, what they seem to be, which kind of leads me to another point. In your book, there's many, many great stories and observations that you've had that both professionally and also just, it sounds like, a passion of yours that you do all the time. And the bottom line, I guess, is that you believe that over a period of experiencing and seeing, your quote is, you know, the plural of anecdote is data. And I think that's a wonderful quote. Maybe you can expound on that from an animal behavior standpoint.
So yeah, you know, a lot of animal behavior research starts with stories and observations. You know, I see a dog do something, you see a dog do something like a certain move in play or a play bow, and then other people see it, and you begin to get a, if you will, a database from which you can do more detailed studies. A good example is when I was once riding my bicycle back into Boulder. It's a story with which I begin my book, The Emotional Lives of Animals. We came around a corner, and there was a dead magpie in the road, obviously hit by a car. And we saw a magpie funeral. And one magpie went in and touched the corpse, stepped back. Another did the same. Another, then one flew off and brought grass back and dropped it by the corpse, and another. And then they all stood silently in vigil, and then flew off. And I was with my friend Rod, and Rod doesn't know much about animal behavior, and he was absolutely stunned. He said to me, "Is that common? Do animals do that? Do they mourn? Do they do this?" And I said, "Well, you know, I've seen it a few other times." And right after I published that observation, I was getting emails from all over the world, people telling me, "Oh, I've seen that in other magpies and ravens and crows." So that's sort of the, if you will, the basis of the plural of anecdote is data. I mean, if I have 10 or 20 people independently tell me they've seen magpies, crows, or ravens hold funeral services like I saw, then it's real. And if, I mean, the skeptics can deny it till the magpies come home, if you will, but it's real, you know, and we have to do something about it. And I had the same observation on my road after a cougar or a mountain lion killed a red fox. The wife of the red fox, I mean, I knew they had been a mated pair. They've lived down above me for years. I watched her basically bury her husband, if you will. She covered him with pine needles and dirt and leaves, and stopped and looked at the body and then oriented herself. So she was intentionally covering him in a certain way. She wasn't just randomly, you know, throwing dirt and pine needles on him. And after I published that observation, I discovered that someone had seen a red fox do that in New England, and that somebody had actually seen a wild wolf do that. So, you know, once again, I think to me the main message is that some of these things happen when very few people have the opportunity or the good fortune to be there. But from the fact that people don't see it happen, you can't conclude that it doesn't happen.
Right. And I think I should also add, as long as we're talking about skepticism in science, that you point out that we have to be careful how far we go with that, and that it is easy to kind of step over that line and read more into it. You know, I have to say, I was in preparing for this, I was listening to an interview you did with Duncan Campbell on Living Dialogues, and someone who I like, and I really enjoy listening to his show for the most part. But I think some of your supporters, and I think Duncan did this in this case, can take these stories a little bit too far in a highly speculative way that turns some people off. I mean, we don't really understand the wisdom of animals, and we really can't be sure all the cognitive processes that are going on. So maybe you want to speak to a little bit how you draw that line as a scientist.
Right, that's a great question. You can take the stories too far, and sometimes I do, and sometimes people do. But as a scientist, I look for consistency, repeatability, and use some reason. I don't feel I'm making too much of it. You know, here's another story I had in my book of this elephant named Babel who had an injured right rear leg. And I observed her with Ian Douglas Hamilton in the Samburu Reserve in northern Kenya. And Babel had an injured right leg and walked like a snail. She was about 17 years old, and she could hardly walk. And the elephants in her group waited for her, went back and got her, and fed her. She was their friend. They loved her. They didn't want to abandon her. They empathized with her. And some of my colleagues said, "Well, that's interesting, but, you know, there must be a reason. Maybe, you know, what could Babel do for them?" Well, Babel couldn't do anything for them. She walked like a snail, and if she had been left alone, she would have been taken down by a lion or a cheetah or a leopard in no time, because she couldn't even really defend herself.
Well, you know, that leads into this whole point about taking off the white lab coat and still bringing your heart and your emotions into your work. In your field, how do you see that playing out between how folks are looking at that now, and is there a shift in integrating the public and private self of the scientists in their work?
There's a real good move to integrating, as you say, the public and private life of scientists, and also of animals, by the way. They're related. You know, publicly now, a lot of scientists are just saying that, you know, they know that animals have feelings, they know they have pain. You know, people who study pain physiology, my God, if they're studying pain physiology, how could they deny that animals feel pain if you're trying to come up with an animal model of pain? But, you know, they're applying scientific standards. But I always, you know, begin my talks with saying, you know, does anybody in this room feel that dogs don't feel joy, pain, grief, sorrow, or, you know, jealousy, say, or something like that? And even at scientific meetings, hands don't go up anymore. You know, they used to, but people will be guarded. They'll say, well, we know they show fear, and we know they show, we really think they show joy, but we're not sure about the more complex emotions like, you know, embarrassment or jealousy.
Right, and I think, as you point out, there's also somewhat of a double standard in terms of where it's easier for us to accept the positive emotions of animals than it is maybe the negative emotions, because the moral implications that we all face of, you know, what if animals really can experience fear and anxiety, what does that mean for the animal awaiting their fate at the slaughterhouse or the calf that's raised in the little bin that we hear about? So there is this double standard, isn't there?
That's right. There is a double standard, but, you know, once again, the tide is really changing, and I think it's because of good science and, you know, people just really being out there and just saying, look, like you said before, if we have emotions, so do other animals. Where did our emotions come from? And the tide is also changing, and people not expecting that emotions among different animals are the same. You know, as I write in my book, there's dog joy, there's chimpanzee joy, there's Alex joy, and there's Mark joy. So, you know, I just think that we just need to be much more open about consistency and hypocrisy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can't apply Darwinian continuity to anatomy and physiology and not behavior.
Exactly.
So you must be consistent.
Then let's go back to something that you talked about before, and that's empathy and the notion of mirror neurons coming into play. Can you go back and explain a little bit about what the science is telling us about the empathy that some animals might experience?
Mirror neurons were discovered almost by accident back in the 90s, and the way they worked were when they were done in monkeys, they were horribly invasive experiments, but maybe we could hope that something good comes out of them for the animals. Say when a monkey reaches for a pencil, certain neurons fire, and when the monkey sees someone else, another monkey or a human reach for the pencil, the same neurons fire. So they mirror the action of another individual. And so you could apply that when I feel something, certain neurons in my brain fire. Say I want to play and I'm happy, and I do what we call a playback, a play invitation signal, and my playback neurons fire. So I know what I want and what I feel when I do a playback. And then if you did a playback and my playback neurons fire, mirroring your action, then I know what you feel or what you want.
Right, at some level, right.
At some level, but that's how people are applying it, saying that mirror neurons, you know, provide a really good foundation for studying empathy. You know, this is kind of setting, if you will, the research world in that area on fire, because now it's not fluffy for me to say, I actually feel the pain of my dog.
Right, right.
I might.
Right.
And it might be because of, you know, mirror neurons.
Right, and we don't know, right? I mean, we have no way of knowing whether the mirror neurons are the cause of or the effect. I mean, whether they're the radio or the receiver, right? I mean, in terms of human consciousness,
right,
there's still a whole, it's just an unknown area. I'm not saying one way or another, but nonetheless, it's showing up that we are somehow connected or have this ability to connect with animals. And I obviously find that fascinating, because I think it ties into this work that I'm trying to help move along of Sheldrick's, where he's saying, you know,
right,
maybe this connection is measurable at a deeper level than we could even imagine, and that's that there's some kind of telepathic level. And I just wonder if this is maybe suggestive of kind of moving in that direction, that if we can form these connections, how far do these connections go? And I guess we don't know.
We don't know, right. And that's why I think the best science that's being done in this area is, you know, science with an open mind, because basically, you know, we're discovering fascinating things every single day. And so we shouldn't be just closing the door on things because they seem to be untenable. You know, I mean, just, you know, who would have thought, you know, in the animal behavior field, you know, who would have thought that honeybees could do different types of discriminations, like same different, which previously was thought only humans and some great apes can do, or they could communicate, the, you know, with such precision the location of food, or that Mexican jays could, you know, remember the location of 90 or 100 different caches of food and remember which ones they went to and not go back to one once they had emptied it. You know, it's amazing spatial memory.
Right. The big story that comes away is we have to be really careful when we start putting limits on our understanding.
Yeah, I mean, I like the idea of not putting limits. I mean, there are limits, you know. I mean, you know, and I don't mind accepting the fact that, you know, it's unlikely that a dog or a wolf or a coyote or a polar bear is ever going to build a computer. They don't need to build computers. You know, that's just not part of what they need in their world. But see, as we come to understand more of their world, we'll also come to understand more of what they need and how they go about, you know, satisfying those needs. And that's what I think is important in the study of behavior, getting the details.
As you point out in your book, it's not just about understanding the animals and understanding their needs. It's about dealing with the implications of that, because you really can't get to that one point and then not cross the chasm and say, wait a minute, now that we understand this, kind of what are we going to do about it? And from a scientific standpoint, I thought what you really kind of raise is this larger question of, you know, value-free science, which of course is just ridiculous. There is no such thing as value-free science. And I almost see what you're moving towards is kind of the other extreme and say, you know, value-rich science. No, let's lead and face head-on with the implications of what we find out. And in this case, it's if animals do share a lot of our same the richness of our experience, then what does that mean for how we're going to treat these beings and deal with them and change the things that need to be changed in order to make things right?
To me, that's the old $64,000 question is, you know, what are we going to do with what we know? And basically, what we're learning daily is about how remarkably bright and intelligent, but more importantly, how emotional and sentient these animals are. And they have a point of view. They care about what happens to them. We're going to have to factor that in, that dogs have as much interest in, you know, protecting their families and avoiding pain as you and I do. And that's going to definitely trickle down to how we treat them and what we're allowed to do. And, you know, hopefully people will, you know, hopefully we won't need laws, you know, but, you know, that people will work from their heart. That'll be the more genuine change.
Well, Mark, that's going to about do it for today. I really want to thank you again. And at this point, I really thought the interview was over and I was about to wrap it up. But then I had a couple of questions for Mark about how he might help and participate helping us replicate Rupert Sheldrick's Dogs That Know experiment. And in the process, he revealed some very interesting, very frank insights about how difficult it would be to find a graduate student to follow up on this research.
Here's the catch-22. They've got you coming and going. If you don't support it, then you've got negative data, and negative data don't make a thesis, and people will say, well, what do you expect? It's a ludicrous idea. If you support it, then it's not explainable within the paradigm of science, and so you don't have anything there. And I think it would be suicide for a graduate student to do in terms of their future. I thought Rupert in one of his studies, and I remember I was one of the tiebreaker reviewers for a paper that he published in the journal Anthrozoos, which was a really good paper, And, you know, it's a point that I make in my books, actually, that I've made in one of my books and also in some papers, that, you know, people can be skeptical, but once again, you've got to be consistent. You know, he put a paper into a professional referee journal. A bunch of referees read it, and they published, and then it was published. What I mean, you can't play the middle from both ends.
Yeah.
That's basically what it comes down to. If I publish a paper in a peer-reviewed scientific journal, then people will say, okay, I may not agree with some of what you wrote, but at least it was scrutinized, you know, by your colleagues.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's what Rupert did with a couple of his papers, especially the one that I know the best, the one that was in Anthrozoist, and it was published. And although people read it and thought, you know, the skeptics said, oh, this is bullshit, you know, this can't be, my response was, well, wait a minute, then why isn't your work bullshit too?
Uh-huh.
You know, it was subjected to the same peer-reviewed system, and, you know, it gets back to that whole notion that we were just talking about, animal emotions, of consistency.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, sorry, you know, it's like the best analogy for what you and I were just doing is that whole thing on anthropomorphic double talk.
Right, right.
Now, why is it anthropomorphic to say an elephant is in pain, but it's not anthropomorphic to say that she's feeling good?
Right, exactly.
Yeah, I mean, sorry, you know, it doesn't work anymore.
Well, it just makes us, it just touches on some stuff that we're afraid of there, and we just have to get over it.
You know what? That's right. One of the things that I'm writing in this new book I'm writing is that people are going to have to learn to deal with their fears.
Absolutely. You know, it's so funny in your work, it's like there's so many religious parallels that are so comical when you step back. I mean, you know, on one side, the science has been this movement against the religious idea that we're special and unique, right? Because that's what the Bible has told us. You know, we're made in God's image and we're special and unique.
Right.
And then when science comes along, or like something your work, I mean, that's really the message from your work. It's like, hey, we're not so special. We're not so unique. We're kind of on this continuum, you know?
Yes.
And then that riles us again. It's like, well wait a minute. We want to be a little bit special and unique.
Right. I mean, it's crazy. But you know, that's where the paradigm shift is coming. I mean, I think that ultimately, you know, we may not be around to see it in full form, but that's what's happening.
That's what's happening. Great way to end that very pleasant chat with Dr. Mark Beckoff. Thanks again for him joining us. If you'd like more information on his books, in particular his book, The Emotional Lives of Animals, please check out our website, SKEPTIKO, that's skeptico.com. You'll also find links to our previous shows and to our forums, and also a place where you can drop me a note. I do encourage you to continue talking about Skeptico, blogging about Skeptico, writing reviews for Skeptico, getting the word out that there is another voice out there that's contrary to some of this skeptical noise that we hear. Next episode, we're going to be wrapping up this three-part discussion we've been having about dogs with our skeptic among the group, Dr. Clive Wynn from University of Florida, who you've heard some clips from before. I think this is going to be a very interesting episode coming up, so please stay with me for that one. And that's going to about do it for today. Until next time, bye for now.
Where's the bluebird of my youth? In the absence of the truth, of the truth. Wailing walls, how could you give up on me?